Not a chance. I said, do you mean, are you expect? That's right. He said, that's right. I don't have it. He said, well, we'll see. We'll see. Direct amends. I tell this story. It's a great story. My last year of drinking, a lawyer in New York who was in the airplane personal injury business wanted to have a book written on wrongful death. There was no book in those days on wrongful death. And he wanted one with his name on it. So he paid me over the course of a summer. The deal was I would write the book and both our names would go on the book and I would get money from him for the book and plus academic credit for the book and he would have a name. If I tell you his name, you'd recognize he's one of the national guys for the airplane accidents. And that was it. And he gave me he had a file, some notes. I taught this stuff at the time. So he figured I knew something about it, which was a big mistake on his part. And he set me up with a dictating machine and his file and all that stuff, and I didn't have to go to the office. I could do it at home, and I had the whole summer off, as you do when you teach. And he was very faithful. Every week he sent a check. And I was very faithful. Every week I cashed a check. And at the end of the summer, there was no book. And I manufactured a big fight with him, and I told him, I want to write Prosser on torts, and you want to write Ginsburg on damages, and how would it? And that was it, and I kept his money. And that was always on my mind. And this guy's first name was Stewart. And he was on a list, of course. And John said, what are you going to do about Stewart? I said, I'm going to see him. He said, Dan, what are you going to do when you see him? I said, I'm going to tell him I'm sorry. He said, what are you, crazy? He said, you're going to go to a New York City lawyer, and you owe him $15,000, and you're going to tell him you're sorry? He'll throw you out of a window. Oh, I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, pay him the money. Now, this is in the 60s. $15,000 is unthinkable. I didn't have $1,500. Yeah. So I don't have the money. He said, well, you wait, you'll see. And the book tells us that a mumbled apology will not do. Right? It says we make amends. It doesn't say we say we're sorry. It doesn't say we apologize. And the book specifically says that's what we don't do. Making amends is putting it back where it was before I got my grubby hands on it. And that means, in my case, that means that my children get back a father. My wife gets a husband. My friends get a friend. My partners get a partner. Put it right back to where it was before I got it. I cannot be like the guy in the book. You remember the moron in the book, the farmer? And the tornado comes along and everything's gone. It's all flat. An idiot comes out of the storm cellar with his good wife and looks around and says, isn't it nice the wind stopped blowing? And he forgets that the whole place is flat. And that's me. I'm not drinking. Isn't it great that I don't drink? Look at me, pals. I got a year and a half. I'm going to these meetings. I don't drink. O'Keefe is back. The world's best lawyer is back on track. You know, here I am. Look me over, pals. I don't drink anymore. I completely disregard. You know what the book says? This is a book written in 1939. It says, sweet relationships were broken. Right? Sweet relationships were broken. And Clown is standing there thinking it's okay as long as I stop drinking. I don't have to do anything about that. That's not the way it works. Not the way it works. I didn't know what to do with Stewart. I didn't have the dough. Says wherever possible. Wherever possible. So I waited and I did other stuff. I went to see people. I made amends and I started. I didn't know what to do about the kids, you know. I said, what do you do about children? I had all these children, 7 children. The oldest one then, well, I guess I had 6, I don't know, but I had a lot of kids. You see them all the time, they're running around in the house, and they all looked alike. They didn't look like me, but they all looked like each other, and well, I'd be going to bed, and they'd be getting up, and, you know, you see them, and I don't know what to do. What do you do with kids? I said, John, what do you suppose? He said, well, just do something, for Christ's sake. He didn't have any kids. So I said, well, maybe I should start going to Little League games. I used to go to Little League games drunk. I have 5 sons, so, you know, Little League. And I would go drunk in my car, and I would park my car in a parking lot. I'd never get out of the car. I'd have booze in the car. And I could see the team. And, you know, Little League, when they put on a batting helmet, they all look the same. I couldn't tell one from the other. But I knew my kid's team. They had the blue hats. So if somebody on the team got a hit, I'd blow the horn. And if it looked like it was my kid, I would blow the horn and turn on the lights. And I suppose the rest of them, who the hell is that? That's O'Keefe. He's out there. I mean, these are just little things, you know. So I said, I better go to the games. And that's so I spent the next 7 or 8 years watching my 5 sons go through the Little League, sitting with the mothers. Oh, never believe that. Mothers, they're vicious. But that's, you know, and it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. I'm supposed to do that. I'm a father. I'm supposed to go to the goddamn Little League and watch, you know, nothing like watching a ball game is 32 to 16 or something, you know. And you know how kids are. You say to a kid, who won the game? Oh, I got 2 hits. They don't give a shit who won. You know? All my little alcoholics. And so, you know, you just do that. You know, just do that. Now when there's O'Keefe, you know, you just sort of show up and try to be nice. It's just hard for me. But I want to get back to my pal Stewart. And time had gone by, you know, and I still hadn't taken care of Stewart. Well, you know the law business we're in. One day there walks into my office an unsuspecting citizen who had a beautiful death case against a major drug company for a drug, the name of which I forget, but it had a side effect. It was a wonderful side effect. Killed people. So I signed him up, and I did a complaint and all that stuff, and I did all the depositions, and it was a death action. As I say, Stewart was very good in death action. So I went down with this file to Stewart, and I said, I got it all set, and it's on the calendar, and it's going to go, and I want you to try it. And when you get the dough, in New York, we refer cases 1/3. When you get the money, I want you to take my part. This is going to be big. It's going to hit big. Take my money that I owe you off the top, and we'll split the rest. And he said, fine. And a little while went by, and the nature of calendars, you know, and he called up. And he said, we got the money on the case. It was settled after about 3 days of trial. It was a lot of money. He said, come on down. So I went down to New York. You have to sign these reporting statements. You report to the client, to report to the court on contingent fees and who shares in them and all that stuff. So I signed all the necessary papers. That was a Monday. Or a Wednesday. It was a Wednesday. And I said, now don't forget. Take the dough off. In the meantime, he said, you know, okay, don't worry about it. So the next Saturday, I was home. And there was a member of our group, Bob Olufsen, was in my house chatting that morning. And the mailman came, and I said to Bob, well, I think there's a check in that mail. I'll take you to lunch. And I opened up, sure enough, there's the law firm. And I opened up this letter, and here's a check for the full amount. In the letter, I don't remember what the letter said, but in effect it said, Dear Ray, here's a check for the full amount. What happened between us was some time ago, and we're willing to let bygones be bygones. We understand that you are engaged, and as I was, in helping other lawyers who have the same problem you have. Good luck. Best regards. That's when I knew the fucking program worked. I don't want to. I don't need rooms to light up, and I don't need wind blowing through the rooms, and I don't need to be transported to that fourth dimension, but you put a good check in my hand. And I get a spiritual feeling that would make Francis of Assisi look like a bum. You know? And I said, holy shit. Now you tell me what that is. Huh? Tell me what that is. What in God's name is that? What is it? Could I do something like, I mean, if you, you know, we're all men of the world, we're all lawyers, we see people at their worst, we know all of the failings of humankind, plus we're alcoholics and we've experienced stuff. Can you figure that? I mean, go figure that. How a New York lawyer is going to do something like that. New York City lawyer is going to do, any kind of lawyer is going to do something. Incredible. Just incredible. It's power. It's what it is. It's power. It's power. It's absolute power. And I went through that list and, God, people I knew I'd never see again, they kept showing up. Where they came from, I don't know. How much were the guy? It was a guy named Vinny, who lived in the town I lived in. I had interfered with Vinny's marriage in a non-sexual way, but I had interfered with Vinny's marriage. And he was always on my mind, and I'd go to nine-step meetings just be a year or two after I had finished everything I thought I was supposed to do. Vinny was on my list, and I always had him on my mind. Vinny was always floating around up there. Only at nine-step meetings. I'd show up at my group, was time for the ninth step, and someone said, well, tonight we're on the ninth step, and I said, ah, shit, Vinny. And Vinny had been was in the construction business, and he'd gone off to Saudi Arabia to build whatever you build. And I knew goddamn well I'd never seen it. And I'm having lunch one day with a guy, a guy, and we're walking out of this place. Who's sitting at the bar with Vinny? He's an alcoholic. He's up there getting a load on it. I said, Vinny. And he said, I said, God sent me to you. He said, what? I said, you remember all of that? He said, sure. I said, well, that was wrong for me to do that. Ah, he said, don't worry about it. It's the best thing that ever happened. That penny ass wife of mine got divorced. I said, well, Vinny, I bought him a drink. I said, I'll see you around. And off I go. Now I don't think about Vinny at all. Except when I talk about them, I think about Vinny. But you know, for years he rattled around in my head. Free rent, yeah? Vinny's living in my head. I can't be effective. I can't be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got all these people running around upstairs here. Yeah? It just isn't, there's no way to do it. I'm satisfied my own way. I've been through the list and, I've done all the things that I'm supposed to. And I have, in addition to the check from Stuart, I've had other just great things have happened to me. Uniformly great things. Although one guy I went to see, I was not allowed to do things over the phone or any other way but direct. I went to see this fellow who lived in town. Lawyer. Sort of a big time lawyer like myself. And I went over to see this clunk. And I said to him, George, you remember all that? And he said, yes. I said, well, that was wrong of me, George. I just want you to tell you that. And if that was wrong, and if there's anything I can do for you in the future, make it better somehow, I will. It was one of those things that didn't involve money, didn't involve anything. Just involved feelings. Bad-mouthing him as a lawyer. And George looked at me, he said, you were no fucking good then, and you're no fucking good now. Get out of here. I said, okay, George. Boy. So I call up John, you know. I said, listen to this. And I tell him the story. He said, so what? So what do you mean, so what? I said, the guy won't sit still and let me amend him. And he told me a very valuable lesson. He says, it's not for him, stupid. It's not for him. You didn't go over there and do anything for him. You went over there and do something for yourself. And you did it. He said, you think the amends are for those people? Not a chance. He said, these are just coincidental people who are going to enable you to live a useful life. I said, well, the amends is not for them? He said, no. I said, well, then the amends are for me? He said, no. I said, well, who the hell are the amends for? He said, read the book, stupid. And the book says this. The book says, of course, it's a given. We want to put our own lives in order. Of course. What the hell else, right? But that is not an end in itself. It's not an end in itself. The real purpose is to be of maximum service to God and those around us. That's what it says. The prayer in the seventh step is to be useful. The book says that the ninth step is so that we will be of maximum use to God and the people around us. The seventh step prayer is answered in the eighth and ninth step. It has nothing to do. I hear people, you know, I don't know why we get such, we have all these amateur psychologists we have running around here. They tell you the ninth step is to relieve your guilt. Bullshit. I said to John, how come I experience feelings of conventional guilt from this disease? And he said, the reason you feel guilt is because you are guilty. And being guilty engenders very strong feelings of guilt. He said, now let's get on with it. You know? And this is it. See? This is it. Maximum service. Maximum service to God and those around us. The book goes on to say, we have to be the Good Samaritan every day. Every day, the Good Samaritan. With no thought of reward. Fortunately, it also says none of us are perfect. It says no one of us is able to practice absolute adherence to these principles. No one. Not Bill Wilson, not Bob Smith, not Don Mucci Grosso. Maybe not me. I don't think they didn't really have me in mind when they said. They had other people. Maximum service. Here's the story. This is my story. I made a deal. Here's what the book says. The book says three things. First, it says God has all power. Correct? Then it says, as we drew near to him, he revealed himself to us. And then it says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. You take those three. He has all power. There is no human power that's going to interfere here, or can. It says he reveals himself as we draw near to him. I'm not a religious person. I don't go to church. I'm not a member of any church. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The relationship with God is the same as with anybody. You meet people, you don't reveal yourself to them. You let them see what you want them to see, correct? Until you get to know them a little better. You get them a little better, you let them see a little more, and then you let them see a little more, you know. They come into your office, they see a lawyer. You're all business. Yeah, that's very good. Thank you so much. Yes, yeah. Yes, there's some truth to that. You know. They don't know that at night you're swinging from trapezes and you're going to hula houses with glass ceilings and stuff, you know. But your buddies, as you reveal yourself to them, maybe they find out, well, you know, what you do in your spare time. You're not always a lawyer running around. How do you do? And that's the way it is with God. The closer you get, the more he shows himself to you. And since the book also tells us he lives within us, the closer I am to you, he reveals himself to me. See? That's the way it works. It says he does not make hard terms. Something we should all understand. He does not make hard terms with those who seek him. Here's my deal. I made this deal. I don't know when I made this deal. I mean, here's my deal. I said to him, to our father, I will be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You do the rest. That's the deal. Simple deal. I will be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And whatever I get from that, I get. And my life is a storybook life, truly, truly. Everything I've ever seemed to want, I am. Without doing very much about it. At all. It's all a gift. It all just comes to me. My sponsor never once told me that I would get back the things I had lost. Never once. He never told me I would live the life that I live. He just told me to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as they said, before we had a book, and before we had the steps, and before we had a program, and when they were struggling, and they had only each other, and the then Oxford group, and they said this, trust God, clean house, help others. That was it. Trust God. Clean house, help others. And that's all he ever said to me. All you have to be, he said, is a regular member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And whatever you're going to get, you get. I hear people say this around the program. They say, you don't get what you want, you get what you need. You hear that? Well, that's horse shit. You know what you get? You get what you get. Whether you want it or need it. You're going to get what you get. And that's it. And what I got is wonderful. I can't tell you. What I got is wonderful. Let me tell you this, just one story. My story entitled, How I Came to Live in Florida. In 1962, I was a tenured professor of law at Fordham University School of Law. And I was asked to leave and forced to resign in 1963. Now, under the rules of the American Law School Association, if a tenured professor is fired, and that has to be with cause, right? In any law school that's approved by the American Law School Association, no other law school may employ him. You fired at one, you fired at all. That's it. Just forget about it. Don't even ask. Don't try to transfer. You never, never get hired again, ever. And I knew that to be true. And I knew it the day I walked out of that school. I knew it. I will never, ever, ever teach a law school class again. Just forget about it. And I brooded about it for 2 years. But I finally got sober, and I didn't think about it. And John never said a word to me about it. And I moved my office from New York City to a city called White Plains, which is just north of the city. It's the county seat of a very wealthy county called Westchester County. And I had gotten to be a senior partner in the biggest firm up there. Very comfortable, making a lot of money. One day, the presiding justice of the judicial department, Judge Hopkins, remember, called me up. And he said they're starting a brand new law school in White Plains, New York. Pace University, which is a large, urban, 30,000 university. He's going to have a law school up there. And he said, they've asked me to go on their board of advisors, but he said, I'm busy. So I'd like you to be my representative and go on the board of advisors to this law school. I said, sure, why not? So I went to the first meeting, and I saw the dean. I introduced myself, and he knew something of me from around town. And we just chatted. And I went to all the meetings. I was very faithful. Advisory committees don't do very much. But I showed up, and he gave reports, and we'd ask questions and back and forth. And brand new school, and had no alumni or anything. And so we were over there. So after a year of that, that dean said to me, how would you like to come over here and teach on a part-time basis? I said, well, do you know I used to teach full-time at school? He said, yeah, I know. I said, well, do you know what happened? He said, yes, I do. I said, well, how can I teach for you? He said, well, I called the American Law School Association in Washington, and they said adjunct is all right. It's perfectly okay. I said, that's nice. So there I am. Now I'm teaching one night a week a course in criminal law. Meantime, I'd been to Fordham. This is like 10 years. I'm into the program 10 years. I'd been to Fordham. I'd been through the dean and all of the faculty, and I made my amends, and everything was fine. And I am a graduate of the school, and sometimes I can be half amusing. So they used to invite me to be the master of ceremonies at their annual dinner, which is sort of a big deal around New York. And I would get up and I would, you know, make feeble attempts at humor, you know, lawyer-type humor. And I would introduce the dais, and the dais was considerable, and there were a lot of senators, judges, and governors, and that kind of stuff. And I had been doing it for several years. And everybody, sort of a routine we'd all go into. And so this, here I am, this night I'm at the dinner, and I'm sitting next to the dean of law school, new dean of law school, the old dean's on the Second Circuit. The new dean, former student of mine. And we're chatting about the old days and this and that, just eating, nothing. I get up and I go through my little number and I'm introducing all these people. And the last one up is the dean. New dean of the school. He's a very decanal, you know, state of the school. You've all heard these stories. And then he says, just before he sits down, I am reappointing Professor O'Keefe to the faculty. The guy who fired me is sitting down here in the dais. I lean back in my chair. Old habits die hard. And then we all went up to his house. We all went up to his house in Bronxville. We all got drunk. I mean, they all got drunk. The old faculty, the new dean, the old dean, me. I'm sitting in a chair in his living room drinking a glass of water. And he's got a load on. Oh, yeah. Now, what the hell is that? I mean, so now, the guy who can never teach is teaching at two schools. I go to the first school one night. There's a note in my box. Please see Professor So-and-so. So I go see Professor So-and-so. I said, what can I do for you, Professor? He said, well, I just have become the dean of a brand new law school in Florida. They haven't even built the building yet. I'd like you to come down and be full-time on the faculty, be the senior tenured professor. Meantime, I got a license in Florida. I got a house in Florida. My firm had an office in Palm Beach. Yeah, I said, well, let me think about it. Now I'm in Florida. I'm in Florida, well, about 10 months. I get a letter from Fordham, from the new dean. And it says, Dear Ray, it has come to my attention that your daughter is graduating this year from the law school. Congratulations, blah, 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 blah. We would like you to come up here and personally give her the law degree and talk to the graduating class. What the hell is that? I'm the one that can't teach. They sent away. Disgrace. In my wall, my office, I have a picture. Giving my daughter Mary a law degree. It still breaks me up when I think about it. What the hell is that? What is it? All I did was be a member here. That's all. I never once asked to be a teacher. It was beyond my comprehension that there would come a day when I would be standing in Lincoln Center in the Alice Tully Theater giving a law degree to my kid. You know what that means? You know the feeling you have? Something like that happens. My God, what is that? I'll tell you what that is. It's a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have come to believe, because of experiences like that, and I'm not being philosophical or anything, I'm just telling you my experience. I've come to believe that things that I can hold in my hand are really not so valuable after all. I've come to believe that things that are physical are really not where it's at. I've come to believe that this program, as the book says, will do for me all of the things I could never do for myself. I have come to believe what the book says, that when we placed ourselves in this program, things happen beyond our wildest dreams. The book says when we took these steps, things happened beyond the best we could plan for ourselves. Beyond the best we could plan for ourselves. It is spiritual, from the first word to the last word, from the newest member to the oldest member. What the gifts are not able to be held in the hand. Not even able sometimes to be explained or comprehended. But it's the work of God every day. In every one of our lives. Deep down, as I said last night and read to you from the book, deep down in every one of us, is that fundamental notion of God. We may bury it over with calamity and pomp and things that are temporary, disappointments that are always temporary. Many, many times in the Bible it says it came to pass. Nowhere does it say it came to stay. These situations come here and they just move through here. And through all of it, there is a work of God. Because there is a plan. I don't know the plan. There is a plan. And we're very fortunate to be part of it. Thank you.
This is the history of AA as I know it. And I sometimes pass myself off as a historian. I don't know when the beginnings of AA really started. I think that it's in ages way beyond our generations that we know about. I think there were forces at work way back through time. But a very interesting cast of characters began to assemble in a little town in southern Vermont called Manchester, Vermont, in the days before the First World War, in the 1910s. Manchester, Vermont is a summer town. It's a very, very beautiful town. It's right where the states of Vermont, Massachusetts, and New York come together. It's about 30 miles north of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. It's about 30 miles east of Albany, New York. and it's on the main route that goes through Vermont Route 7. And in Manchester, Vermont, before World War I, there was a boys' preparatory school. And down from a town called East Dorset, Vermont, which is about 10 miles up north on Route 7, came Bill Wolfson to be a student at the Manchester Preparatory School. And over from Albany, New York, with his family, who maintained a summer residence there, came a son of a prominent family in Albany, New York, the capital of New York State, named Ebbie Thatcher. And up from New York City through Newport, Rhode Island, came the son of a very wealthy family that was in the chemical business and were one of America's most wealthiest families. And his name was Roland Hazard. And from Brooklyn, New York, for the summer, came a physician named Burnham, who brought with him his daughter, Lois. And these young men and the young lady met, and they intermingled, as young people do, prior to the war, and they hung around the Manchester Country Club, and they took their little trips to Equinox Mountain and things like that. And then the war came, First World War, and they all dispersed. Bill Wilson, who had graduated the Manchester Preparatory School, also had graduated Norwich College in Vermont, which is a semi-military school. And he had a commission in the Vermont National Guard, and that it was an artillery unit, and they went over to France, and you know he writes about that in the big book in Bill's story about being in England and in France, and his battery gave him a medal. When the war was over, they all sort of reunited there and interacted as they were supposed to. And then they went upon their own ways. Bill, of course, went to New York City, went to law school, worked in the insurance business, and then he got into the securities business. Hazard went into the family chemical business, and Ebbie Thatcher tried to become a certified public accountant over in Albany. And Lois and her, Lois was seeing Bill down in New York. And the first one to get in trouble with alcohol was Roland Hazard. And he was in serious trouble with booze, and because his family were so wealthy, he went through every doctor there was in the United States, every rich sanitarium there was, and nothing worked. So finally the family decided they would send him to the then greatest psychiatrist in the world, Dr. Carl Jung, who was in Switzerland. And so the Hazard family sent Roland over to see the Jung, and he spent a whole year in Dr. Jung's institution there in Switzerland. And at the end of the year, Jung said, "We've done everything there is to be done for you, so you have to go now. You've been here a year." So he left there, and he got to Paris, and someone asked him the wrong question. Somebody asked him if he'd like to have a drink. So he did, and of course he was immediately drunk as he ever was. And he went back to Jung. And that's when Jung pronounced the death sentence on him. And this is all described in our big book, at least his dealings with Jung are described in our big book. And as our book tells us, Jung said to him, "I have never seen an alcoholic of your type recover." And Jung, and Hazard, of course, said, as you would say, or I would say, "Is there no hope at all?" And Jung said to him, "Yes, once in a great while, people like you have a religious experience. And that phenomenon of religion so displaces the personality that they don't drink." And Hazard said, "Well, how do I have this experience?" And Jung said, "I don't know. You just have to find a religious experience." So Hazard, Roland, then went to England. And while he was in England, he heard of this Oxford group. Now, the Oxford group were a group of, I guess today we would call them charismatic Christians. It was started by a man from Pennsylvania named Frank Buckman, who got into a lot of trouble later on. But it was very well established at this time. And the theory of the Oxford group was, and Buckman told these people, that he wanted them and himself to be like first century Christians. That is to say, Christians who lived within the first 100 years after the death of Christ and before the real foundation of an institutional church. And these first century Christians, according to Buckman and according to the Oxford group, practiced first century Christianity in the sense that they were absolutely charitable, absolutely honest, absolutely pure, absolutely loving and all that. And Roland Hazard got very interested in this group, and Roland Hazard became sober. Even as you and I use that term, not just dry, he became sober as a member of the Oxford group. So much so that he brought it back with him to the United States, and because of his family's wealth, he had this house in Manchester, Vermont, outside of Manchester. It really was one of the bigger, larger Vermont farms. Vermont farms are not very big because there's so mountainous there. But it was a very nice place, so Roland formed what amounted to a commune there in the 1930s. And the commune was based on the rules of the Oxford group. And it was right outside of Manchester, Vermont. The next one who got in real trouble was Ebbie Thatcher. Ebbie's family had exiled him from the home in Albany, New York, where they lived. But they allowed him, he was in exile, they allowed him to live in the family summer home in Manchester, Vermont. And Ebbie was driving his car along one of those tricky Vermont roads one evening, and he ended up in a farmer's kitchen. He didn't quite make the turn. And he stepped out of the car in this man's kitchen and said, "Does anybody have a drink?" Vermonters are not notorious for their sense of humor. And so he ended up in front of a judge. And the judge told him the usual judge stuff. You know, if I see you one more time, you're really going to get it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, a couple of weeks went by, and the one more time came up. Because Ebbie, in a fit of alcoholic enthusiasm, had decided to apply a coat of paint to the exterior of the family home. You know how that goes. He did all the alcoholic stuff. He got all the equipment. He got the ladders and the paint and all of that business. And he put about, you know, half a coat of paint on half a panel of the house. And then he stepped back to admire his handiwork. And he was sitting on the lawn in a beach chair with a bottle of whiskey. And a bird came along and shat on his paint job. So he went inside and he got a shotgun. And he spent the next half hour trying to kill the bird by shooting it with this shotgun. Well, if you've ever been to Manchester, Vermont, it's just a gorgeous, small, sleepy, picturesque New England town. You don't go around shooting off shotguns. So he came back in front of the same judge. They only had the one judge. And he asked for the usual phone call, and he called, who else? His pal, Roland Hazard. And Hazard came down from the commune and told the judge, "I'll take him. We have a bunch up there. We're trying to do something with, and they're all drunks. And I'm a drunk." And the judge gave Ebbie Thatcher to Roland. And Ebbie stopped drinking. Ebbie never really got sober, as I use that term. He had long periods of not drinking. But he never really got sober. Which, the moral of which to me is that the thing of value is not the messenger, but the message. He was not a worthy messenger, Ebbie, but he had a message. And so he then came to New York City with Roland Hazard, and The Oxford group was vaguely associated with the Episcopal Church in those days. And there was a church in New York, it's still there, the Calvary Church, it's in the 30s on the east side. And if you go there, you'll see the main window of that church was donated by the Hazard family. And attached to the church, they had a soup kitchen, because this was the Depression. They were handing out meals to whoever needed it, including the drunks who were in the neighborhood. And Abby Thatcher was on the soup line handing out the soup. And his, in his own words, he says that the thought just came to him one day. He doesn't know where it came from. The thought came to him, I must call Bill Wilson, who was over in Brooklyn, my old pal. And he did. And Bill says he heard from his old friend. You remember in the book? And he invited him over. And Bill's wife had gone to work, and Bill had a couple of bottles of gin. And he said, good, my old friend will come over, and we'll go out in the kitchen, we'll open up the booze, and we'll talk about the old times, including the time. They were the first people to land at the Manchester airport, because they landed before it was open. Manchester built an airport, they're going to open it like on Saturday, and these two guys showed up drunk on Friday in a small plane from Albany, and they landed the plane, they got out, and of course they were arrested, and you know, they had these adventures. And Bill, in the book, said, we'll talk about these old times, and Bill says the doorbell rang, and he opened it up, and there, he said, stood my old friend. And Bill said he had a light in his eye, something different about him. And Bill said, what happened to you? And Ebby said, I got religion. And Bill said, a crackpot. First a drunken crackpot, now a religious crackpot. But come on in anyhow. And there'll be more gin for me, thought Bill. And they went out in the kitchen. And Ebby began to tell Bill his experience with the Oxford group and about what Roland had done for them, their old friends. And Ebby said to Bill, Bill said, well, I'm not much for that religion stuff. And it's all in our book. And Ebby said, well, the way we do it is you form your own concept of God. And that got Bill's attention. He thought that was terrific. Now, Bill didn't stop drinking. He continued drinking. And in December of 1934, he did stop drinking. You all know the story. Bill went to, for his eighth or ninth time, he went to Towns Hospital, which is no longer there. It was there when I came into it. It was a double brownstone in Central Park West, if you know New York City. And Dr. Soakworth, the little doctor who loved drunks, ran it. Soakworth was a neurologist, but he couldn't get a job for the Depression, so he took this job and he ran this place. He had been running it for years. And Bill got, they had a couple of freebie beds, and Bill got one of the freebie beds, and Ebby came to visit him. It says in our book, my friend came to visit me. And when Ebby came to visit Bill, Bill says in our book that Bill admitted to Ebby that he, Bill, knew that he was powerless over alcohol. He told Ebby that he would make restitution for all the harms he had done. And he told Ebby that when or if he got out of this place and didn't drink, he, Bill, would spend his life trying to help drunks. Then you turn the page. It's when you turn the page after Bill has gone through a rudimentary form of our steps, before there was any program at all or thought of it, then Bill has what the old-timers used to call Bill's hot flash. Bill has that spiritual experience in his room. He was in a great fit of remorse. He couldn't sleep. We all know this feeling. Everything around him was doom. He was a failure. His job was gone. His money was gone. His poor wife had to work. He was a bum, etc., etc. And he threw himself on the floor. And he said, if there is a God, if there is a God, let him show himself now. And Bill reports that his room lit up with a light, the intensity of which was so great that he could no longer see the walls. And he said a wind blew through that room. Don read it last night and transported him into a fourth dimension. And he said to himself, so this is the God of the preachers. And of course, when it all subsided, he sent for Silkwick. Silkwick examined him. Bill told him what happened. And Silkwick said to him, I don't know what happened to you. But whatever it was, you best hold on to it, because you're much better now than you were when I saw you 3 hours ago. And shortly thereafter, as Bill says in his book, he left the hospital trembling. He said, trembling, I left the hospital. And Bill had no job, but he did go to work with Ebby and Roland on the soup kitchen. And while he was doing that, Bill tried to interest some of these people who were coming in for the free food in his recovery. And in this recovery, he also frequented some of the bars down in the 30s trying to interest people. And the way he was doing it was, he was telling them about how his room lit up. You know, if you were standing in a bar and some big, tall, skinny gink comes walking into the bar and is not drinking, first of all, you immediately suspect him, right? What's he doing here if he's not drinking? And then he wants to tell you how his room lit up. Yeah. So he went back up to Silkworth at Towns, and he complained to Silkworth. He said, I'm running around, I'm telling them all my room lit up. They want to listen to me. Silkworth said, that's not the way to do it. He said, what you have to tell them and press upon them is the fatal nature of this disease. They're going to die. Tell them that. Well, through a series of coincidences, shortly thereafter, Bill was part of a syndicate that wanted to buy one of the smaller rubber companies in Akron, Ohio, and they went out there to negotiate the transaction, which never did happen. And it came to be Mother's Day weekend, and everybody else had enough money to go home for Mother's Day except Bill. He didn't even have enough money to pay his hotel bill. In fact, he had $10. And he describes how lonesome he was. Everybody left him. It's Mother's Day. He can't get home. He don't have enough money. And he was in the lobby of the old Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio. And they had a bar on the ground floor, and he could hear the barroom noise. I think it was a gay bar, because he said, I could hear that gay crowd inside. Now remember, this is a man of some intelligence, graduate of law school, who 6 months before, this is May now, 1935, the third weekend of May is Mother's Day. 6 months before, this guy had God in his room in the hospital. He was face to face with the light and the power and the wind. And 6 months later, he's thinking about going into a bar and getting drunk. And he's saying to himself, I'll go in, I'll have a ginger ale. Maybe I'll strike up an acquaintance. You know, maybe I'll get laid or something. It shows you his spiritual experiences don't last that long. In any event, he went through the directory of churches trying to find somebody who'd be interested in this. Now, here's a curious thing that does not appear in our literature. The woman he ultimately got a hold of through a minister was a woman by the name of Henrietta Seibeling. And Henrietta Seibeling was a daughter-in-law of the Firestones. Pretty good. And she lived on the guest house on the Firestone estate. And Henrietta was a member of the Akron, Ohio Oxford Group. And under the practices of the Oxford Group, they had a practice which we have adopted of open, they called it open confession, telling everybody your faults. And if a member of the Oxford Group told about his problems at the beginning of the month, the way they did it, the practice was that every member of the group would get up in the morning and pray for the member who had the problem. And as it was, in the first week of May of 1935, a physician named Bob Smith, a member of the Oxford Group, told his fellow members at an open discussion meeting that he had a drinking problem. And he was at the end of his wits. He had lost his accreditation at the local hospitals. His wife, of course, was the usual wife of an active alcoholic gone crazy. And he asked them for help. And they, the Oxford group of Akron, Ohio, agreed to pray for Bob. So every morning in the month of May, Henrietta Seiblings was on her knees asking God to send some help to Dr. Bob. And now she's in the guest house of the Fire Island State. On the other end of the phone is a man she's never met, doesn't know a thing about him. He calls up and says, "My name is Wilson. I'm from New York. I'm here to fix drunks. And Dr. Amos Tunk, the minister, told me to call you." And she said, "Of course." "Of course. I've been praying all month for you. Come over to my house right away." And over he came. You know how drunks are? They're very resilient. He doesn't have enough for the hotel bill. You know, he's $10. He goes over to Henrietta. She said, "Don't worry about the hotel room." And she puts him into the country club, the golf club, where all the rubber guys hang out. And she said, "Now I'll get Bob." And then she called up Dr. Bob. It was a Saturday before Mother's Day. And Mrs. Smith, Ann Smith, said, "Bob is here, but he is passed out under the dining room table." And she actually said, "He brought me a potted plant, but he's more potted than the plant. So I cannot bring him over." And Henrietta said, "Well, I'll put the guy up at the club, and you bring the guy, you bring Bob on Sunday." And Sunday morning, poor Bob, you know, who's suffering, Henrietta says, "You have to go." I mean, Mrs. Robert Smith, Ann Smith, says to Bob, "You have to go over to Henrietta's and meet this man from New York." And Bob said, "I'll give him 15 minutes. I would have not even given him that. 15 minutes, he says, for them. This is what they call Bill today in Akron, Ohio, for that guy from New York. And over they go, and we know the rest. They spoke together for 5 hours. And what Bill told Bob was what Silkworth told Bill to tell. He told him of the fatal nature of alcoholism. Bob, as a physician, knew it, but he had never really applied it to himself. Now, we all know Bob got drunk again. Bob got drunk in June when he went to Atlantic City. He came back from Atlantic City. He made it as far as his nurse's house, and Bill had to fish him out of the nurse's house the next morning and drive him to the Akron City Hospital, and he gave him 2 bottles of beer and 2 barbiturates, and Dr. Bob went up and worked on some guy's ass. You know, we dress him up. He's a surgeon. He was a proctologist, which is not a bad specialty when you think of what he's going to deal with for the rest of his life. I remember so well, I wonder if you remember that film they had a couple of years ago with James Garner and James Woods. You remember that? James Woods is a friend of my son's, and I've met James Woods a couple of times with my son. And I thought the best part of that movie was when they came together, Garner as Bob and Woods as Bill. And Garner sort of looks at Woods and gives him that professional medical crap. And he says, "Just what is it you think you can do to help me, Mr. Wilson?" And Bill looks at him and says, "I'm not here to help you. I'm here to help me." And, you know, I digress a little. About a week after that film, a man came to our AA group because he saw that show. I wrote to James Wood and I told him that, and he wrote me back a nice letter. But anyway, it seems to me that this mix of people who all started out knowing each other in this little town in southern Vermont, seemed to me that, like, I don't think Bill Wilson and Bob Smith ever stood a chance. This is why they were sent to live here in this earth. This was their destiny. This is what they were here for. God knows they did it well. So that's my version of AA history. Now, tonight I'm on the program. I'm scheduled to talk to you about the 11th step of our program. The 11th step, of course, is not possible without the first 10 steps. More especially the 10th step because I have personal experience with this, a great deal of it, and I am unable to do anything about the 11th step unless I am current and do a 10th step. If I have something running around in my mind, some resentment, some negative thing like that, I cannot pray and I cannot meditate. I've tried it, and if I'm thinking of killing you, I'm not going to be able to effectively pray or meditate. So one of the great functions of the 10th step, other than the continuation of the inventory process, is to get me into a state of mind where I can do the 11th step. Now, the words of the 11th step, there are more words in the, if you're interested in words, there are more words in the 11th step than any other step. It says that the men and women of this program sought to improve their conscious contact with God as they understood Him through prayer and meditation, praying only for knowledge of His will for them and the power to carry that out. And I think that the first word of that step has meaning for me. They were seekers. They sought, you know. They were seeking something. I think that was pretty much how I was, generally speaking. I was a seeker all my life. I'm not sure what I was looking for in those days. I know now, but I didn't know then. But they say they were just seeking God. And this is consistent with all of the other things of our program. They never said they found God. They just said they sought God. And we have really no answer here, you know. Our own book says we have no monopoly on any of this stuff. And there is no chapter in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, entitled, This is the Answer. We don't have an answer. If you want an answer, well, I'll find Tammy and Jim and talk to them. Maybe if you're in a motel in Louisiana, maybe you could run into Jimmy. Because I've heard these people, and they say they have the answer. I listen to them. I like those guys. They run around, jump up and down. Jimmy plays the piano. He cries. It's marvelous. And he's got the answer. I heard him say it. He says, I got the answer. He's got it right in his hand. This is the answer. This is it. Oral. He's got the answer. And if he doesn't have the answer, maybe his cousin Anal would have the answer. Well, we don't have that. We do have a chapter that says there is a solution, you know, and that's what we have. We have a solution to a very specified problem. Solution to the disease of alcoholism. That's what we have, and we seek. There's no guarantee that we're going to find. The book of 12 and 12 says sometimes we get a glimpse, just a glimpse of God's will. But we seek to improve our conscious contact with God. Therefore, there must be a contact that we have established somewhere to improve. And I suppose, I don't know where I made this contact. I'm sure it was very, very early in the first or second step. See, there are two things. One is the practice of prayer and meditation. And the other is the step. When I was within a week of Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean my first week here, first few days, John said to me, we pray around here, and you're going to pray. And because it was true then, I said to him, I don't pray. And I didn't have a habit of prayer. I didn't go to church. I wasn't interested in things like that. Busy. I was all the time busy, busy, busy. It's hard work, you know. It's hard work, drunk. It's hard work trying to make believe you're not drunk, and when you're drunk all the time. And, you know, we're lawyers. It's hard to be a lawyer and stay drunk all the time. You know? I had an older brother who died on the Bowery. He didn't have that problem. But all Billy had to do was wake up, panhandle some money, get some booze, and he was all set for the day. I had to find a suit that I hadn't set fire to, and a tie that I didn't throw up on, and a shirt that I didn't put a hole in, and I had to make believe I was sober. It's hard, hard work, so I never had time to pray or anything like that. Plus, I knew it didn't work. And he said, "You're going to pray." And, of course, what he said was what I did. And so he told me these prayers are very simple. He said, "Say help in the morning and thank you at night." And that's exactly what I did. No more, no less. Help in the morning, thank you at night. And this went on for a period of time, and I began to sense, you know, you just sense things. Maybe this was helping me. So I sort of expanded my prayer life. And I said, "Help me today." And that night I'd say, "Thanks a lot." And then I expanded from there. And finally, like most of us, and through the guidance of a sponsor, I have now a daily routine, a habit of prayer. And we all have that, I think. I say certain things in the morning, certain things at night, and I say certain things through the day. And the contact here is a conscious contact, it says, and that's the front part of the mind, front part of the brain, to be conscious of this fact. One of the greatest gifts I've ever gotten in my whole life from anyone or anything I've gotten here, and that's an idea of God consciousness. I am conscious every minute of my day that because God is, I am. I'm conscious of that. I'm aware of that. I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I have, and sometimes I think it's considerable, and everything I am, and sometimes that's considerable, is because of this program. God consciousness. And I have a conscious contact with God. I know that. The question is how to improve it. Well, they give us the methods. And the methods are as old as civilized man. Prayer and meditation. To meditate, to give thought, it's from the Latin meditare, to give thought to your condition, to think. I think of myself, and I do think, when I think of myself, I do not think of myself as a professor of law or as a retired New York judge, or as a member of a law firm. I think of myself as an alcoholic. I really do. Because the other stuff is accidental. And it's all been a gift anyhow. But if it weren't for this program, I wouldn't be anything. Quite sure I'd be dead. So why shouldn't I improve this contact? Now, I had no experience with meditation. You know, my education, maybe I missed it. I mean, maybe they did it sometime when I wasn't there. But in the school system I went to, I did not hear any discussion of meditation. I had sort of a thought. I thought it was sort of vaguely Eastern, you know, Buddhist or Hindu or something like that. But whatever it was, I hadn't the slightest idea how to do it. And when I got to the step as a step, which was after my first year here, and after I had done the amends and so forth, I had to go to get instruction, and I asked John about meditation. He said, "Well, read the 12 and 12. And here in the 12 and 12, it says that for beginners in meditation, that was me, we found it helpful to read the prayer of St. Francis several times slowly. So I read the prayer of St. Francis several times, slowly, and nothing happened. And you know I am not, don't ever want to be an AA heretic, but the prayer of St. Francis is too much for me. It's a great prayer for a saint. I feel just the opposite. I would much rather get than give. I would much rather be understood than understand. And every time I read or read that prayer, I feel, oh boy, I'm nowhere close to this. And just So I had to find another way to meditate. Now, I'm going to tell you what I did, and this is what I actually did. Don was a witness to it. But I have to issue an injunction against you. I forbid you to do what I did. I don't want you to do what I did. I forbid you to do it. I command you not to do it. That's, you know, all the alcoholics in the room now run out and do it as soon as they leave. Just to be perverse. I am a voracious reader, and I was reading a book in those days by a man named Kelly. Kelly, improbably enough, was a Quaker. I was very impressed with the book. And when I finished the book, I got out the telephone book, and I looked under churches to see if there was a Quaker church nearby. And there was. There was one up the road in a town called Rye, New York. So for the next 3 years or more, every Sunday or first day, as the Quakers say, I drove up there and sat with the Quakers. It's a great religion because it's my kind of religion. They have no clergy and they have no services. What the Quakers do is they'll be in a room like this, not as tastefully arranged as this, and they have these chairs and front benches, and you sit for a full hour, and if you are inspired to speak, you speak, otherwise you just sit. Now, for people who know me, they find this very difficult to believe. I sat there for more than 3 years and never said a word. But I did learn to sit down, and I learned to be quiet. And I learned to be still, or Manucha, whatever the name of this place is, it's still. And I learned to just think about things. And it's ancient wisdom. Ancient wisdom. You know, nothing we have is new. Nothing we have is different. We just borrowed from everywhere, and we applied it to this very specific problem. And when David, of the prophet, when he meditated on the God of his understanding, and he came out of where he was with his little harp to sing his song, and he looked around that desert, and he saw that sky, and he saw all the brilliance of the desert stars, without any lights to interfere with it, this enormous universe that was above him. And he played on his little harp, and he said to the God of his understanding, "What is man that you are mindful of him? We are so small, we are so insignificant, and you care for us." And that same, in the same book, in the same authors, they say, if you seek God, be still. Be still. And know that I am God. Those were the instructions that were given to the prophet. Be still. And know that I am God. And I learned from the Quakers to be still. And I'm not a theologian, and I don't claim to know very much about this, but I have this practice. And I asked John, when I finally got still enough, I said, "What do you think I should meditate about?" Well, he said, "Why don't you think about what you can do for your group? What can you do for your AA group? That's a good subject to meditate on. So you don't have to get Eastern. You don't need a chant. You don't need robes. You don't have to get your head shaved." He says, "Think what you can do for your group." Nice to do this. I said, "Nice to think. What can I do? What can I do to make my AA group a more effective group?" Because the book says at this point of our development, we are to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And there were certain things I could do in that group. I changed the format of some of the meetings. I got a coffee pot. We were drinking instant coffee out of these aluminum things. They were awful, terrible, you know? Got a coffee pot, had to make real coffee. Used to bring cookies and stuff like that. I bought some aprons for the guys who worked in the kitchen. Got to be sort of a status thing. If you had an apron on, you're okay. You know, you're one of the in group in the elite. And I saw great results from this kind of meditation. One time I was asked to speak at a breakfast in Philadelphia on a Sunday morning, and I went down there, and there was a large breakfast. It was in one of the big hotels in Philadelphia. And somebody down there had determined that the groups, since there were so many more meetings, this was in the 70s, than there was in the beginning, Philadelphia should have this one monster meeting where everybody could come together and see each other, because they weren't doing that anymore. And so they had this breakfast called the Unity Breakfast. I went down and spoke at it. And when I came back, I was talking with Don and some of the other fellows in the group. And one of them, a fellow named Harry, that week meditated that way about that breakfast I told him about. Harry came back the next week and said, we, this group, should have such a breakfast. So we did. We all got the group, got together, and we went to a little, very little restaurant in town there, and we had our Unity breakfast. We had 125 people show up for the first breakfast. About 3 years ago, I was asked back by the same group to speak at the 20th breakfast. They had 1,500 people there at the Rye Town Hilton in Westchester County. Harry meditated on an unselfish subject. How could that little group of ours be effective? And that little group of ours, the one that Don and I were in, grew and grew and grew, and it was very effective. It was the Walk on Water group in that area. You know? They knew you were solid if you came in. Because we had this group practice, group meditation, group prayer. It was wonderful. Then other ways that I meditate, I don't know why this would help you. This is what I do, whether it helps you or not, I have no idea, but feel free, of course. Use whatever you think. I do this. I have a good memory, a very good memory. And I remember back to the 6 months before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the second time. And I remember very well where I lived, how I lived, what I did, what I thought about, what my life was like. And then I think back from 6 months, say from now, back to last January. And I do the same thing, how I live, where I live, how I operate, and what I'm all about in the last 6 months. Then I make the difference between those 6 months and these 6 months. And boy, oh boy. Some days I'm just driving that car and I think about something like that and it just, the tears well up. Such a difference in my life now, my life then. And I realize and I make the connection how all of this came about. And I meditate that way. Prayer was something I knew about. I knew about prayer. Anybody who's been through the Roman Catholic school system knows about prayer. I knew all kinds of prayers. I knew prayers in English. I knew prayers in Latin. I knew prayers in French. I knew prayers for all occasions. In our church in the Bronx, where my mother used to make me go, we used to pray for everything. We'd pray for the intentions of our Holy Father, the Pope. We would pray for the crops. In the fall, the priest would say, now we're going to pray for the crops. Because there was nothing growing there except a couple of the Italians were growing marijuana around the corner. But we would all say, Lord, bless the crops, us, you know. We had prayer for peace, prayer for war, prayer for rain, you know. I knew all kinds of prayers and all. But what I knew were the words of prayers. I had all the words. I had none of the music, you know. I didn't know how to pray. And this says you pray only for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. The words are very simple. It eliminates a lot of foolish prayers. Only knowledge of God's will. It eliminates prayers for personal gain. It eliminates any prayers for success or anything like that. 12 and 12 is very clear on it. It says even praying for other people is a temptation. We should mind our own business. Other people have their own powers greater than their own. God knows all of us. I don't have to pray for you. You can pray for yourself. I should mind my own business. Pray only for knowledge of God's will. And so I have very simple prayers that I use. One I mentioned last night. I think it's a good prayer. Show me the way. Simple enough, huh? Show me the way. We have formal, we have our own prayers. We have a third-step prayer, a seven-step prayer. We have our serenity prayer. We have things like that. But I use this short-form stuff. I like that. Show me the way. Most of the time, I know what I'm supposed to do. But a lot of the time, I don't know how to do it. I just don't know how to get where I'd like to be. And I ask, show me the way. Show me the way. Sometimes I have a good prayer that I use. I think it's a good prayer. I think it's a great prayer. I think it's probably the greatest prayer I know. Here it is. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I say it all day long. Thank you. Thank you. I have this idea of God, you know, the Father. And he comes into where he is in the morning and he says to the man in charge or the angel in charge, he said, what's going on? And the angel says, well, 500 million guys want jobs. 600 million guys want money. All the guys want their wives destroyed. But there's one guy down there in Miami keeps saying, thank you. And God says, give him anything he wants. I have sort of an idea of that. And John told me that he said this step, first of all, I think that this step is the powerhouse of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that all of the power, and it is considerable, it is the power that brings you and I together on a weekend such as this. It's the power that reached into my life and into your life and took me from there to here. And you know, and I know, that there's no way that you can get from here to there. You just can't be done. Look, just think when you meditate back to where you were and where you are, there's no possible way. It just can't be done. That same power, benevolent as it is, looked down at me one day and said, you see this one here? I can use him. He will be useful. And he brought me over here. To you. Made me useful. And I think the admission of powerlessness at the beginning of this process by you and by me, by all of us, sort of the power just begins to drop, come down this way. And it comes to rest in the 11th step, and then we send it back out and up. See, tomorrow I'll be talking to you about the 12th step, and as I see the 12th step, that's really just two things. First of all, it is the result of the first 11 steps. And secondly, it is my instructions for the future, how I am to live my life. I am to carry this message and practice these principles. So the last step here, this one, the 11th step, I think is the powerhouse of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it is the last of the healing steps. John gave me this parable. He said that the 11th step and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is like a gift that you give to a small child. And those of us with experience with babies, we know. You know how it is with the kid in his first year, or first 2 years even. If you give him something at Christmas or his birthday or whatever, and you give him the gift and it's all wrapped up in the paper with the ribbons, the kid will very often mistake the wrapping for the gift. He thinks you give him the wrapping paper, right? He takes the wrapping paper over, makes a nice noise, he plays with it, he eats it, sticks in his mouth, gets the ribbon, he's having a hell of a time. You figure, what did I buy him anything for? I gotta give him some toilet paper, he'd have the same. And that's the way it is when you give a gift to a child, correct? But as he gets experience in receiving the gift, then he knows that the real gift, the thing of value, is in the bottom of the carton. And so it is with us. See, when we come here, when I came here, the second time I stopped drinking, and I got all the benefits of stopping drinking. Physically, I slept well, I ate. And I got my job back, and yeah, and I looked better, and I felt better, and my clothes began to fit, and all that stuff, and I put a crystal on my watch, and I made all kinds of improvements. My dad took me a year and a half with a crystal on my watch. And I stopped limping. I had this alcoholic neuritis. I used to limp, and my right leg was numb right up to my hip, and I talked vaguely about the war. You know, they said, what's the matter with your leg? Well, I don't want to talk about the war, you know. I was in the service. I had nothing to do with any wars, I assure you. But I felt good, sir, and I felt good. And I said to him, this is it. He said, this is not it. It's not it. I thought it was it. No. Well, that little lady, you know, the old brain began to work. I could read and retain what I read. I did the New York Times crossword puzzle with a pen, of course, boop, 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 like I always could. But I couldn't do it when I was drinking. I just lost it. I'm not interested in that shit. You know, I couldn't do it. And my brain began to click again. And I thought, my God, my incredibly honed mind is beginning to function. This is it. Truly, this is it. And I said to him, this is it. I'm back. He said, that's not it. See, that's the wrapping. That's the wrapping. That's not the gift. The real gift is down here in the 11th. The real gift is a conscious relationship with God, which is something we seek. I see the program now, the entire program, as a search, my search, for an understanding of my relationship with God. And this step is the direct access to that. I mentioned those prayers, and I pray them on a basis. 12 and 12 is very good on this subject. And it talks about the value of prayer and meditation. And it says that we discover that we do receive guidance for our lives to just about the extent that we stop making demands on God, right? Humbly ask, say please, say please. Making demands upon God to give us on our order and on our terms almost any experienced AA, and I'm an experienced AA, will tell you how his affairs have taken remarkable and unexpected turns for the better as he tried to improve his conscious contact with God. He will also report that out of every season of grief or suffering, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new lessons for living were learned, new resources of courage were uncovered, and finally, inescapably, the conviction came that God does move in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. And I can tell you that because since I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous, not every day has been the best day of my life. I have been through 2 coronaries, 8 surgical procedures on my eyes, you know. You have days like that. Well, and those were moments of grief and moments of suffering. But through it all, I knew that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that, as our traditions say, a loving God watched over me. And I cannot say that I went through any of that without fear. I had fear. But the fear was a temporary.